So you're listening to Corporations and Democracy. In the second half of today's program, we're going to look in some detail at what the new NAFTA needs to protect workers. Our guest for the second half is Celeste Drake, Trade and Globalization Policy Specialist at the AFL-CIO. She advocates there for reforms to U.S. trade policy that create shared gains from trade on behalf of working families. Her master's in public policy and Juris Doctor degrees are from UCLA. She taught economics and world history at the high school level and then served on the staffs of two congressional representatives and eventually clerked for the Honorable David Thompson of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. And that was all before joining the AFL-CIO. She's testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, various House subcommittees, and the U.S. International Trade Commission. And she's made presentations before the European Union's Economic and Social Committee and now sits on the Advisory Committee for the U.S. Export-Import Bank. So let's look at what NAFTA and free trade agreements need to protect working families. Celeste Drake, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Hi, Steve. I'm happy to be here.
You've looked closely at the U.S. Trade Representative's goals for renegotiating NAFTA that they put out and found some interesting language, language that's so vague that you don't know what it means, coded language that means stuff that you don't think it does, a lot of omissions. And you bring a lot of thought and experience to how to work to change this. In addition to the nuts and bolts of the stated goals of the new NAFTA, we'll get some sound advice about what to do. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about some of the leadership here, the Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer and the U.S. Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross. They actually seem to cross-talk each other.
They do, and it's pretty interesting. So when you look at the current administration, you can find a big chunk of it is really sort of the traditional Wall Street corporate folks, the Gary Cohns and Steve Mnuchins, you know, could have been in the, you know, George W. Bush administration, and they would have a more typical view supporting the corporate trade agenda, which was something that President Trump campaigned against. And then he's obviously got the racist, you know, proto-fascist wing of folks in his cabinet. And Lighthizer and Ross are a little bit different, not from anything that we can tell in either camp, do have a different point of view on trade in that we should indeed look at the U.S. trade deficit as a drag on our economic performance and a drag that hurts workers by limiting the number of jobs in the economy and the wages that workers can command for those jobs. And there seemed to be, especially at the outset of the administration, perhaps a little bit of back and forth or friendly rivalry. We don't know about who was really going to lead the trade agenda. But as it settles into NAFTA negotiations, for instance, it does appear that Mr. Lighthizer has taken the lead. And, you know, the how much space he has between these two other main wings of the administration to actually do something good for workers is a pretty small amount of space. And I think that those who are seeing if there's something that can be gained here that's positive and that doesn't compromise our values about including all workers and being part of a global labor movement that's fighting for good things for all of us. I think that we're fighting to do that, but really sort of looking at a narrowing space where folks are becoming less and less optimistic that we will be able to achieve something.
Yeah, I know we're going to get into what some of these provisions are that you've been looking at in the provisions that were published by the trade representative, so the kind of what they're talking about doing. But first, I did want to have you say a little bit about how you work with people that you disagree with and why you should.
Yeah, that's an important question, and we do hear that a lot, especially with this particular president and a lot of folks saying, you know, resistance means never talking to them at all. And sort of we look back on you know, some of the greatest movements, workers' rights movements, civil rights movements, you know, the women's rights movement. And to be successful, the idea is you keep, you don't compromise your agenda, you keep pushing your agenda. And, you know, if you're invited into a space with those you know you don't agree with, take that opportunity to push your agenda. And I think it's the sort of the difference between, you know, considering that entering into a dialogue about, you know, what it is that we can accomplish is quite, and where you say, these are our demands, and you're very clear about both your values and your principles as well as your demands, is quite different from, you know, finding something acceptable that curtails somebody's rights on the one end but provides benefits for others on the other end. Because it's quite clear, once you were to say, well, it's okay to violate the rights of Mexican workers or immigrant workers or anything, then you've acceded to it's fine to violate rights, and you're just talking about the who. So that's not what we're talking about, but what we are talking about is that silence won't help. And so it is very important to let the administration know what we want on fair trade, let Congress know, let even, you know, state and local officials know what we want on trade, so that there becomes a louder chorus for trade reform, and that creates a space. You know, the mainstream media is quite happy to tell a story of two options on trade, either the status quo, which is based on neoliberal economic rules that benefits wealthy elites, or this sort of protectionist xenophobic view that came out in the Trump campaign for president. But, you know, the real work of taking down the Trans-Pacific Partnership, for example, was not done by Mr. Trump. It was done by a progressive group of labor, environmental, faith communities, farmer, rancher, getting together and saying, we have a different vision. That's pro-trade, but where the rules are progressive, promote a sustainable economy and inclusive growth. And so if we're not engaging in telling that story is not going to be told. So that's why we think it is important to keep engaging where there are spaces to engage, where we can say, here are our demands, but we're not compromising on our principles.
Looking at the stated goals of the U.S. Trade Representative's Office, an interesting thing that you found is it only mentions workers in two places.
Absolutely, and that was pretty disappointing. And we conclude from that the renegotiation is not likely to be designed to benefit workers. The document should specifically say that working people are among those that will benefit, but instead what we saw is a conclusion that says, under these objectives, a new NAFTA will give our farmers, ranchers, service providers, and other businesses new opportunities to grow their exports and reclaim American prosperity. But most importantly, the new NAFTA will promote a market system that functions more efficiently, leading to reciprocal and balanced trade among the parties. Now, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that until you ask what's missing. And you say, what, you know, promote a market system is fine, but we also want to say, address market failures, because that's one of the things that pushes down wages and keeps workers from being able to exercise their rights, is where you have failures, for instance, where there's too much market concentration or too much power in the hands of employers and too little in the hands of working families.
Yeah, that's interesting. I just wonder where those two mentions were.
They're in some of the introductory statements where they say they admit that NAFTA created problems for workers, and that's a great statement because there have been past administrations that tried to poo-poo the idea that workers were actually harmed. And then they mentioned that in the past, politicians have given workers hope that trade would be reformed, and that's also an important admission, sort of that workers have been told this before, we're here to fix trade, and then, you know, we worked on that, and then we're disappointed. So those are good inclusions, but by the time that you get to the more operative function, what the objectives are intended to accomplish, Now working families are nowhere to be found.
Wow. One of the words that you found, efficiencies, sets off alarms in connection with food and safety standards. What's wrong with efficiencies?
Well, again, if efficiency as a concept, it's a great concept. But what we see in trade agreements and in the decisions that come out of the World Trade Organization, the WTO, is that efficiency is given a whole new status that's seemingly more important than other goals. So governments have many functions. One is to promote trade. One is to protect national security, to protect consumers, you know, all kinds of things, you know, making sure that we live in a clean environment. And the problem with too much of a focus on efficiency is that it leads those who are making decisions about trade quite frequently to say, this important protective regulation is inefficient. It is interrupting trade. It's restrictive on trade. And therefore, we're going to say it is illegal under this trade agreement. And then a country has a choice. They can maintain the regulation and be subject to tariffs that are imposed by other countries, or they can repeal the regulation. And so an example of that kind of thing was the recent repeal of country of origin labeling for beef. That was challenged at the WTO. Mexico and Canada said, this is a technical barrier to trade. You know, it's cost too much to comply with, and therefore it discriminates against exports from our countries of beef to the U.S. And the WTO, ignoring the fact that, you know, consumers do have a right to know about the food that they buy, said essentially, yes, this is not the least trade restrictive regulation you could have imagined, and therefore it violates the WTO, and therefore the U.S. should repeal it or face tariffs. And in the end, Congress voted to repeal it. So this is the kind of thing where we get a great concept like efficiency, but we raise it up to a level where other considerations like the protection of health, the provision of information to consumers, get undermined in this quest for the least trade restrictive regulations.
So is this expected to be the first of many items for which country of origin labeling will be rejected or be declared illegal?
It's on the issue of country of origin regulations. I've not seen attacks on that specifically, but there's a long history of attacks on dolphin-safe tuna labeling. Mm-hmm. Several years ago when Congress passed the very important anti-smoking bill that gave the FDA the authority to regulate cigarettes, that also included a ban on clove cigarettes because those have a sweeter taste and they're viewed as sort of an enticement to younger children to try out smoking and get them hooked. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, there was a challenge there saying, well, Indonesia is the biggest manufacturer of clove cigarettes. Clove cigarettes are not made in the U.S., so this is a way to discriminate in favor of U.S. tobacco, you know, cigarette producers and against Indonesian ones. So it's oftentimes you don't know where the trade complaints are going to pop up. We do know that the U.S. has longstanding complaints of this type that it uses offensively against other countries. So it tries to make sure that other countries are obligated to import, for instance, meat that's treated with hormones and antibiotics, mm-hmm. even if the other countries don't want to, or are obligated to import grains and foodstuffs that may be genetically modified mm-hmm. If other countries are reluctant to do so. So it's a game that all countries play, but primarily it's because these corporations are seeking to use trade to overrule, you know, decisions that have been made domestically and often democratically by citizens. And so these global corporations really view trade agreements as a way to undermine democracy, which is really pesky to them.
Yeah, pesky old democracy.
That's such a fundamental principle. Not just democracy per se, but even state constitutions and stuff, which you know declare rights to health and safety and such. To change the subject a little bit, what do you have to say about funding or lack of funding for implementing trade agreement issues and customs and trade goals?
Absolutely. So this is definitely an old trick that's used to sell trade agreements, to say we have strong enforcement provisions or we have strong guarantees that our customs and border protection unit will be able to inspect this or that. And those are all fine, but if they come with sort of authorization but no appropriation, as we would say in the domestic context, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean very much. And so this is critical, whether it's do we have enough customs agents to inspect food for food safety, or whether it means are we really overseeing the labor and environmental protections in our trading partners and making sure that we're not importing goods that were made with forced or prison labor, or that we're not importing goods that were made in ways that are critically damaging to the environment where people live. And if they don't come with full funding, which has to be, you know, either guaranteed in the text of the agreement, which these agreements never do, or included in the implementing legislation as mandatory funding that's not subject to maybe it'll be appropriated and maybe it won't, then a lot of it is sort of these words without the backing behind them. So it's something to watch out for, and that citizens should really, you know, again, take with a grain of salt, saying these promises of strict enforcement aren't meaningful until we see that they come with a real commitment to spend the money on the enforcement.
You mentioned technical barriers to trade, and you were also talking about wording taken from the TPP, but also from the World Trade Organization. These things all kind of line up against each other. What do you see from the WTO that's happening in the renegotiations of NAFTA?
So it's interesting. The reason why the U.S. government has sort of backed away from the WTO and started the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations, the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership negotiations, the NAFTA renegotiations, are because the U.S. government is viewing the WTO as a less effective place to advance all of these neoliberal rules. And it was largely because, you know, there are so many countries in the WTO that many are saying, wait a minute, particularly the developing countries, we were promised all of these benefits. We're not really seeing them yet, and we want to revisit the rules. And unfortunately, the USTR, almost no matter who's been the president, isn't that interested in revisiting the rules, but really marching ahead and unfortunately advancing primarily the goals and interests of the global corporations. So with, you know, the TBT measures, it goes back to these questions about let's look behind the words. We have things in the stated goals about science-based regulations. And again, science-based sounds good, and it sounds like something that progressive folks have been fighting for. We want to address climate change because the science demonstrates that it's happening and that we must act. But science-based has been used in the WTO and other international trade agreements to really attack protective rules, for instance, rules against dangerous chemicals, when companies are able to show that they have a counter study that shows that the particular chemical they manufacture isn't, in fact, an endocrine disruptor or isn't, in fact, a carcinogen. So we have to really look much more deeply into these rules and say, hey, generally, we should assume that a country's protective regulations are legitimate and reasonable, and it really should be considered a very rare instance where it can be challenged as something that's really an overt discrimination against a good from another country, and really kind of flip that assumption on its head. But unfortunately, if you look again at the administration's objectives for NAFTA, it looks too similar in these areas to the TPP, which just leaned over far too much in the corporate direction, and not nearly enough, you know, was designed to protect and benefit working families.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like the there's a setup here for what I would refer to as public science versus private science. You know, the companies that the manufacturer, you know, new chemicals, as an example, they always have studies that say that there's not a problem at all. And whatever studies they have that say there are problems, they just keep it themselves and don't report. This is something we've talked about on the program in the past. So it sounds like the setup for that that conflict is you know, it would be in NAFTA as it is.
Yeah, that word science, too, they use it the other way around, too, so that if you have some toxic problem in your environment, they can say, well, you can't prove that it's hurting you, you know?
Exactly.
Could you comment a little on currency manipulation and one of the things that the U.S. government says they want to fix, but how does it look for making any progress on that issue?
So currency, if you go to the, you know, the old David Ricardo, the theory behind free trade to begin with, part of the assumptions that you have to make for all of the theory to play out is that currencies are free floating and they will change and adjust in value in response to what's happening in the economies of the countries. And that's why, you know, in the end, trade deficits and trade surpluses are eventually supposed to balance out. So under the old trade theory, you couldn't have, you know, this 30-year sustained, rather large trade deficit that the U.S. has had with China, for instance. Mm-hmm. And largely that's been because China manages its currency and until very recently was keeping it low to create trade advantages. So, again, this is something that the president talked about while he was campaigning, and there is a proposal to put something about currency in the NAFTA, which, again, on the surface appears to be positive. We want to start somewhere with currency rules, so why not start here? It's an open negotiation. But the goal, again, the stated goal fails to mandate that the currency provisions will be strong, enforceable in the core text of the agreement and subject to trade sanctions. So it leaves open the possibility that whatever a new NAFTA might say on currency would be similar to what came up in the TPP, which was a completely unenforceable side agreement. It was essentially a guideline, and it would not have protected countries from other countries playing games with their currency. And so it's an important thing to address, and, you know, particularly if one is interested in developing countries actually developing, we should, A, address currency manipulation and misalignment so that countries aren't using that as a sword to hurt workers to another country. But we should look at, well, why are developing countries, why might they be motivated to do this, and can we use other policies to help them boost their economy in ways that aren't, you know, in the end tearing down and hurting workers elsewhere. We want to envision a trade relationship that lifts up all working families and raises wages everywhere. And that's not yet what we've seen from the NAFTA objectives from this administration.
Some people think that the problems are too big to tweak. The whole thing has to be recalled and replaced. What is your feeling?
I think that's right. And if you look at the AFL-CIO's recommendations about NAFTA, they were very thorough, very specific. We had 18 specific areas that we wanted to see improvement. And if all of our changes were made, it really would be a whole brand new NAFTA. It wouldn't look anything like the first one. And I think that's exactly where the administration has to go if it wants to, in the end, complete something and pitch it to the American public as better. If it does only tweaks, which it looks like it might do, given that they want to finish by December, that's not going to work for working people. That won't fulfill the promise that the president laid out in his campaign, and it certainly isn't going to benefit jobs and wages either in the United States or across North America.
Yeah, okay. So I want to thank you so much for all that. Where can people find all these AFL-CIO recommendations?
They can go to aflcio.org, and if you just Google AFL-CIO NAFTA and recommendations, you should pull up a page where you can get sort of the 50-page long version or the 2-page summary. Folks can also check out our blog and sign some petitions there telling the administration that it's got to do a worker-centric NAFTA and telling their members of Congress to, you know, do specific things to improve NAFTA, centered around taking away the corporate power and making it more of a people-centered deal.
So, well, I want to thank you again for being our guest. And again, aflcio.org to find your work. I found the 18 specific recommendations was easy to find on the site. And then I had to search the site for your name. That's Celeste Drake to listeners. And you can find your work there. So thanks again for being with us.
Thank you, Steve and Annie. It's been great to be here.
You've been listening to Corporations and Democracy, broadcast on second and fourth Tuesdays from 1 to 2 p.m. here on KZOI X and Z. The next edition of Corporations and Democracy will be in 2 weeks, September 26th, with host Linda McClure. Annie and I will return on Tuesday, October 10th. For further information about what you can do to correct the corporate dominance of our democracy, go to www.thealliancefordemocracy.org. Thanks for listening.